What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Orale Bo Hides. As I'm sitting here and this squirrel is mean mugging me, looking at me like this fool got snacks, but I don't. My guest today is...
Doña Junta.
What's up?
Hey.
So Doña Junta and I go way back, and this has been a great opportunity to not only talk about what you've been doing lately, but also just to catch up. So y'all are going to be in for a great conversation.
Yes.
But where are we right now? Tell folks where we are.
We are at Ken Machado Harbor Park in the city of Harbor City, right on Vermont. So it's a man-made lake, much like our favorite lakes in LA.
Yeah.
But they just renovated it, so it's pretty nicer now. So yeah, Harbor Lake, right here in the city of Harbor City, right next door to Wilmington, San Pedro.
Yeah, I was more than happy to come down here and make the trip and meet you where you are, because, you know, you are my guest. And tell us a little bit about what we just ate.
So we went to Tacos El Goloso.
And it's like gluttony tacos.
Yeah, so it's definitely my once a month treat, because I try to eat healthy now. But, you know, those tacos are just bomb. We ate the birria queso tacos.
Like queso birria tacos.
Queso birria, yeah. Tacos, where you dip it in the consomme and the salsa and stuff.
Yeah.
They're amazing. So worth it. Tacos,
yeah.
El Goloso.
I remember somebody telling me that the whole dipping your tacos in consomme thing was, that's not something you do. It just started with like the new trend of birria.
Yeah. I mean, like how we were saying, birria used to be a wedding or quinceañera thing.
Yeah, a special occasion.
Yeah.
You know, you find somebody on the weekend and you buy 5 pounds of it and take it home.
Yes. And I even used to complain about having to go to parties and always having to get birria, rice, and beans. But they just reinvented the birria in a different way. So
yeah.
It's much more pleasurable to eat, I think.
There's more options now in terms of people doing their own birria recipes. But also the options of like, or do you want goat or do you want beef?
That too.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And yeah, it's just more accessible. You don't have to wait till Sunday to go to the señora's house.
That's
or
true.
Whoever restaurant only sells it on one day a week.
Although I think that the places that only do it like on a weekend probably have it easier, and it'll probably taste a little better, like as opposed to like going to a place where like, it's a Wednesday, you just go get it.
Yeah.
You know?
So birria is kind of the trend, and they were good.
Yeah, thank you for putting me onto that. So yeah, Doña Junta and I have known each other for, given this is 2021, like almost 10 plus years now.
I think it has to be plus.
Yeah, right?
We didn't calculate the year.
No, I'm not good at math. But we first ended up meeting back in the day on the collective group blog, LA East Side.
Yes.
But as I was looking through your own blog, I also noticed we were both at the same place in 2007, which was the sticker show Peel Here, put on by Sticky Rick.
Yes. So, yeah, we're talking about 13, 14 yeah. years ago. Yeah, in 2007, I submitted stickers with my graffiti art on it, mm-hmm. along with my friend Opia. I think it was the first time. He
nice.
Had a few shows after that. And that was the first time that... I think he had it... I think it was kind of by the LA Trade Tech?
Behind.
Yes.
They call it the Ghetto Mansion.
Yes! Oh my God, I totally forgot the name.
Yeah, that was a dope time. Because that was also... We were talking about this before. That was also the first time I wrote something for LA Taco outside of my school newspaper.
The school newspaper. But I don't think we met during that event,
no.
But I guess we were there, and then later on we met.
Yeah. I was like, dang, trip out. We've been, like, in the similar circles for a while and
yes.
shit. So, shout out to Sticky Rick. I'm hoping to one day, like, get him on the show, too, because that fool has stories.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to see that. And I still see him on Facebook, I believe, sometimes
yeah.
here and there.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
Yeah,
we need to reunite with him one day.
He put on some dope art shows, but... For folks that aren't familiar with the space, what was LA East Side? Like, tell them a little about it.
So, LA East Side was a blog, WordPress blog, that was founded by El Chavo, right? And
mm-hmm.
Annie. I believe they both founded it founded it, but they're the one that found it, and they were highlighting, for the most part, stories of the east side of LA. And I don't know how they found me or you, but
they just hit me up one day.
Yeah, same thing. But I think that I think before LA East Side, there was another, like, Met Blogs or something like that.
There was, so this, you have to think back to, this is like the 2008s, 2009s of the internet.
I think 2007.
2007s, you know, so a while back when this was very common, the blog was a normal thing to have. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they just reached out to folks who were doing this dope stuff and who... We were all POC. You know, there were folks from, like, the neighborhood or grew up in the neighborhood, and they had stories to share.
Yeah, and I think I started commenting on Chavo's post. I think he had his own really ancient blog.
Yeah, Lincoln Heights.
Yes. And it was like...
Oh, no, he calls it Chamfles.
Chamfles. And it wasn't even WordPress. It was like a homemade website or something. Probably. I don't know what it was. So I started commenting on his post and, like... I think the Met Blogs, and I don't know, there was a bunch of things where people started getting to know each other's names on there.
Yeah, it became an online community.
Yeah, just like now, like social media.
Exactly, exactly. All these years later, and it's the same bullshit.
Yeah. Just a little bit slower, and I mean, I don't know, but yeah, definitely, yeah. That's how LA East Side, Chavo reached out, and I think I already had my blog, Swap Me Chronicles, and they had seen I was... posting about different things in LA.
Yeah.
And he reached out. And at first I was like, well, I don't live on the east side. So I was a little bit like, should I be able to be on the blog? But he was like, no, it's, you know, that doesn't matter because I you know, you're able to still write about it or even bring stuff up that it, in the way that, you know, we're presenting it, whether you lived in it or not, you know, in a respectful type of way.
Yeah. No, we think there's a lot of universal experiences that we share, given, you know, how we grow up and where we grow up. And despite the different distances between cities and communities, it's still kind of amazing that, you know, being so far away, a lot of things are still the same.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So a lot of growing up in the hood, you know, going to corner stores, going to swap meets. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a lot of good times back then.
It was. And I had explored the city already with graffiti, so I felt, like, comfortable in all parts of the city.
Nice.
So even though I wasn't there, I still knew the area and kind of about it, so that kind of gave me more insight on the east side.
Yeah. And then also, we also got to know each other through Slanguage with, you know, shout out to Mario and Carla.
Yes, Mario and Carla.
Yeah. Because I remember y'all were doing tours. You would do all this, like, random but super cool stuff. It's like, dang, I want to hang out with y'all.
Yeah, so that came a little bit later. I had been working with them since I was, like, 18. They had opened the first space here in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. Art studio, because they were just graduates from art school and they were trying to bring something different to Wilmington, just like in Boyle Heights. They wanted to bring something different. So that's how I started with them. And, you know, with that, we wanted to do tours, and we started a thing called Tourists in My Own City.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah, because of the fact that just because we live here doesn't mean we really know the history or even heard it before.
Yeah.
Or really appreciated or embraced it. So we were tourists in our own cities, and we kind of started it that way. And, you know, doing little, you know, tours for our friends and stuff. I wish it would have really expanded at the time, but it just kind of started with an idea like that.
I mean, that's all it takes. You just start something out, you get the homies together, and, you know, just do it for fun.
Yeah.
I think when the intention goes beyond just having fun and having a good time with friends and trying to monetize it or trying to be famous or something like that, that's when it starts going a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, hopefully we can do more of those in the future. Vaccinated tours.
Yeah, I think so now. I mean, I'm sure the opportunities will be there. Just have to take action.
Yeah. So let's get right into it. You kind of already talked about this, but where did you grow up?
I grew up right here in the Harbor area, San Pedro. And it's pretty much at the end of the 110,
yeah,
the last city before the sea. before the cliff and the ocean. So it's a little port city. You know, it's not super tiny. I mean, I'm sure most people gone there to get mariscos at Portugal. Everybody knows about Portugal. So yeah, in this area. But like I mentioned, I always mention this, that Wilmington is also like, most of my friends were in Wilmington. So growing up, Wilmington was also part of that. And just, you know, all the cities around here. But yeah, in San Pedro was, you know, where I actually grew up.
Yeah, that was we were talking about this before we started recording, of how we met up at the taco spot. And it's like, fuck, the refinery is right there.
Yeah. That was the norm. Like, yeah. Having all these refineries around and the port with all the ships and containers and
the trucks and the traffic.
These refineries, not here, only here, but deeper in Wilmington, and in, you know, it's all around.
Did your parents always live here, or did they move here and then you were born?
Yeah, they when they came from Mexico, they came here because, you know, like back in the days, like if your family came to one city, like everybody got called to that city. So I believe that their family members were living in San Pedro because a lot of them were working at the canneries in Terminal Island. So during the 70s and stuff, the canneries would hire people that were undocumented. And that was an easy place to get a job. So they all kind of moved to San Pedro and then they all worked at the canneries.
And that was that was such a long time ago.
In Terminal Island, yeah.
Yeah.
The canneries later, you know, went out to sea. There are some
overseas. Yeah.
So that, but it originally started with kind of them, like job opportunity. We're gonna go to the canneries.
Yeah, I'm sure it was good while everybody was still here. What did they end up doing after the canneries left?
Well, they stayed there. You know, back in the days, you stay at a job for like 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So they stayed there till retirement.
Oh, wow.
So I think my dad had an early retirement because right when the canneries moved to Samoa, I believe, he was like 63, so he did an early retirement.
Oh, he was old. Oh, yeah.
But he had been there like 30 years.
Damn. Mm-hmm.
And then my mom, same thing. She hadn't been there 30 years. She only worked like 10 of the years and mostly... more ama de casa. But worked some time there as well. He worked at, I think it was Nine Lives, which did cat food.
I was about to say, like, did they ever bring cans home?
Yeah. They done tuna, like chicken of the sea, Charlie tuna, whatever that tuna is.
I think Starkist. That's the one with the dolphin.
Maybe. There's Starkist, chicken of the sea, and then they also did cat food. Those were the main, like, cans. And then the other type of seafood, like calamares and stuff.
Oh, wow. I don't...
Calamari? Yeah,
those are things I wouldn't eat from a can now.
No, they were fresh to be packed for, like, you know, restaurants probably and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. So my thinking is, like, it's going to be canned and it's going to end up, like, in the East Coast or something.
Oh, no. But that industry, they moved, like, many other industries in the U.S., went out of seas, overseas.
Yeah, that's a familiar story for a lot of neighborhoods here. Did you ever think that was something that you were gonna like follow in their footsteps because they had the job and the connect?
No, because you know they were living were survival type of mode, right? They would take any job, not any job, but that was the job that they were able to get because, you know, being undocumented. Later on, they got documented, but, you know, you stay at your job for very long at the time, and you're just all about working and, you know, paying, you know, taking care of your kids and rent. And,
just getting by.
Getting by. So, I never, to me, as a kid, it was like a smelly place that I didn't see. I wish now I would have took photos of the whole area. It was a trip.
Right?
Yeah. It was a trip. It looked crazy, like a industrial, super dope industrial area. And it smelled really bad, but it was really old warehouses from like the 1920s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because the port is really old. So it was Terminal Island and all that. When that was built, a lot of those old buildings were still there. And I remember them, but we didn't have cameras back then.
No, not the way like we just pull out our phone now.
There was cameras, but we couldn't afford one.
And then you got to go develop it and keep doing the same thing over and over again. No, yeah, I think I started reflecting on that when I was looking through some of your older blog posts and social media posts of how even you, when you were doing this, and we'll get into it later, but how you were taking photos of the neighborhood back in those days in the early to late 2000s, and how much now, like how much time has passed now and how much more different those places are probably now.
Yes. And one of the photos before, during that time, the type of photos was, and I think Chavo, he was the kind of the first one that would take photos of like random like signs and, you know, like little handmade signs,
yeah,
and
businesses
like,
and things like that.
Like Mexican businesses and like kind of street rugged stuff that you would see. He was really good at finding that. And I started really noticing that in whenever I go out in the community and started documenting some of that as well, like places or just random kind of setups you would see, like clothes hanging with, you know, a paletero right there or something,
yeah,
like that, you know?
Yeah, things that like just come to mind like that, because I think for me, I'm very much in that place now again too, of things are changing so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, I wish I had pictures from like X amount of years ago to remember how it was or how it used to be. Because I think now that I'm getting older, for sure, I'm finding myself, especially, you know, my girlfriend Marisol from New York, we get into a conversation like, oh, that's there. And I was like, well, oh, 10 years ago, it used to be this. And before that, it used to be this. And, you know, really,
yes,
having like a visual proof of like, that's how things used to be before now. Like when we were talking about how CVS goes into historic buildings and then just goes in there.
Yeah. It feels awkward or looks awkward.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. So what was it like for you going to school back in the day here?
As far as in my younger years, I mean,
yeah, you know,
school
just like
wasn't such a priority
back
then.
Junior high, high school.
Yeah, junior high. Which it was called junior high, and then later called middle school. It wasn't too. It was still during that time influenced by, I think, like the gang culture was still was very prevalent.
Oh yeah,
and you wanted to like, the cool kids were, you know, the gang members and who you see. So, you know, those were kind of like the friends that ended up kind of maybe going that route.
Mm.
And then in high school, it kind of changed a little bit because I started discovering the beginnings of at least my experience with the rave scene. And
I remember ravers in high school. I was like, oh, that dude has an action figure on his neck. Like he's wearing it like a necklace. That's super cool. And then all the beads and like the, the Junko jeans.
Yes. So those years of high school, like, I transitioned for me. I didn't go the gang route. I went more the rave route. So a lot of the friends that were kind of into the gang stuff, they thought we were weird.
Yeah.
Weirdos. I think they used to call us weirdos.
I think it's also to an extent where, like, it's not even worth messing with you because, you know, you're just too different.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to if you're, like, a rocker fool, they can still mess with you.
Yeah. So, and then that transition into getting to know the graffiti writers, like after the rave scene, it kind of transitioned into the graffiti scene and it kind of blended in between two, but then it kind of just became strictly the graffiti scene.
Nice. Yeah, that's a trip. I didn't know you were in the raver scene.
Yeah.
I'm kind of tripping because I like sometimes like watch random things on YouTube and news reports about raves back in the 90s were like, dang, that was like so ahead of its time. And now it's like EDM and all these festivals and shit.
It became really mainstream.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess that happens with life. Things are gonna be, but it's a trip because during the rave scene, we were proud to be underground. We were proud to like be different.
Yeah.
It wasn't documented on TV. The music wasn't played on the radio. Mm-mm. You know, it was like, we had our own identity.
This is and a total subculture.
The parties were like, you know, you got to call a number and like
get
the address. And I mean,
you had to work for it.
If there was a big rave, like together as one or something, it was the most would probably be like $50, the most. And that was starting to get expensive.
Yeah.
But now they're like $300,000.
Man.
If you want to be VIP and all that.
It's so a whole festival, yeah.
It changed completely, yeah. But I know, like, you know, the younger generation is, they're experiencing it different.
Yeah.
Like anything else, I guess.
Do you still listen to music from back then?
Recently, I found some old tapes.
All right.
There used to be Acid Mixtapes.
Nice.
It was a company called Acid Mixtapes, I believe. And you used to buy the tape from a catalog, a paper catalog. You would send your money order and...
You have to wait.
Yes.
No next day delivery.
And I found some tapes like Jungle, R.A.W., DJ Tron, Hardcore, things like that. So I haven't played them because I don't have a tape player.
Shit, that's a problem.
Yes. I need to get a tape player to kind of revamp that. But when you would go to raves, you would see the Acid Mixtape booth. Mm-hmm. So you could buy them there too.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. But yeah, I need to go back and actually listen to some of these things, but...
Be like, boots and pants, boots and pants.
Exactly.
With you and the blog and what we'll eventually talk about, I wanted to talk about, like, the origins of it, because I'm super curious about it. I don't think it's something we ever talked about before, but for you, you know, when did this passion for architecture, this appreciation for it, this love for it, how did it start? When did it start?
So, it started with graffiti.
Mm.
Because we were going out there trying to bomb spots. And bomb, what I mean by bombing, so you won't think it's... The audience think
context,
that...
Context.
The audience won't think that we're, you know, hurting people. But we bombing a spot means that you go to a spot, a building or a lot, any kind of wall space or tarp or whatever. It doesn't even have to be just be a wall. It could be a car.
Yeah.
But it has to be abandoned or vandalized already. You would put your name up on that spot. So putting your name, your graffiti name on the spot was called bombing the spot or bombing. So bombing was... You know, people get really intricate with it, but, you know, it could be basic letters and, you know, with different colors. And then it could be a throw up, which could be really simple, bubble letters. It depends.
Kinda depending how much time you have.
But you're trying to go there quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we were out there scouting spots, whether we scouted it before in the day and then went back at night, most of the times... It was places that were very neglected.
It's abandoned.
Abandoned.
Not a lot of people.
Right. Or just, you know, something that was seen from a freeway or visible from the street. Because part of it was that you wanted your name to be seen by other writers.
Mm-hmm.
Or the public, I guess, but other writers as well. Like, oh, this person is getting up. Some spots could be low-key, like hidden behind, you know, in train tracks or something, or some spots are in your face.
Yeah.
So during those adventures, we would go to a lot of weird abandoned places. A lot of them were buildings. So that's kind of like going in there in the building. But during that time, I wasn't appreciating the architecture of it. I didn't really pay attention to... What was the history of it before?
Because you were there for other reasons. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So it wasn't until later where I ended up developing more of a curiosity about the place.
And how did that start? Did, like, one day you're just like, huh, I wonder what this place used to be. Let me look this up.
Well, so aside from the graffiti, I did at one point want to be a photographer.
All right. Nice.
Yeah. So after high school, I, like everybody else, goes to community college.
Yeah.
Maybe not everybody else. Some people probably go straight to college.
But most of us.
If we don't have mentors and stuff, we just kind of fly by. So I wanted to be a photographer, and I took a photography class at the local college here.
Nice.
Harbor College is right behind us.
Shout out.
And it was, back then it was film.
Yeah.
You know, strictly film. So I started having an interest in photography. So I would go to places and take pictures of... I still had an attraction for very neglected things. Very, you know, what other people might think is ugly or abandoned or, you know, hit up or decaying. I don't know. I think that's beautiful. To me, it was beautiful. So I would start taking pictures of places like that. And more of a, in an artistic photography type of way.
Okay.
So that's kind of where I was just taking the pictures because I really liked how it looked. As far as research for it later, again, that came way later when I started digging more into that. I think with the, over the years, my growth in that became more prevalent.
Yeah, it shows. The way you post on Instagram now and the way you talk about things on the podcast, it shows that you have been very much not only learning over the years, but you take it seriously. You take it as a responsibility to, like, present somebody with, like, here's as much as information about the history of this, where it is, when it was made, who made it. You know, those kind of details that can be very easily overlooked.
Yeah, exactly. And at one point, I did overlook it myself, like, not really knowing or paying attention to the architecture of it or paying attention to maybe the year it was built or any of that or why anybody built it or what it was until later.
Especially the way you were framing it with when you were doing photography and just, you know, being very casual about it, that kind of information back then wasn't easy to find. Do you still think it's not easy to find now with the internet?
As far as information on a place?
Yeah. Like, let's say we were walking by something and you're like, oh, what is this place? Let me see if I can find information on it.
Well, there is, you know, how we were talking about Google. People could Google, like, things that are places that are more popular and get some basic information.
Yeah.
But I think what grew my passion for research was pretty much going to college.
Okay.
Because we had to do research and write a thesis and all kinds of stuff. So that taught me how to actually research even more and enjoy it in a sense. Even though when you're in school, you're like hating it because you don't have a life and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it gave me a skill set to be able to, you know how to research some of these places and where to look. Probably a little bit deeper than maybe somebody that might Google it because nobody's teaching them research methods.
No.
Right?
And, I mean, the other thing too, and you just said it, is I wouldn't necessarily know where to look. Because I would just randomly be searching for things online, but I'm sure you have, like, go-to websites where you're like, let me check this place first before I start other places, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. So, and it's all public information. I mean, it's not anything I have hidden or anything, but some things, of course, you might need a library card or you might, you know, I went to Cal State LA, so I still have access to their databases.
Nice.
Because as an alumni, you still have access.
Hell yeah.
After that. So maybe those things, but most of the information, you could find it from the library databases.
And take advantage of the resources.
You just kind of dig from there. But, you know, I mean, with research, that's why there's kind of a, you learn how to do it on your own, but it's also when you get taught it, I guess it makes sense now why they were teaching
us how to
research.
Makes it a lot easier. You know, like, what keywords to search for,
yes,
or what kind of things to, like, plug into search engines and things like that.
Exactly.
Definitely a method to the madness.
Right.
With you, you know, picking up these skills more and your relationship with it, did you ever think, both when you were younger and, you know, as you got older and got more into it, did you ever think, I could make this in my career?
Well, I did go to school and I wanted to do journalism. So I didn't major in journalism. I majored undergrad in sociology because sociology is a study of, you know, people and places. And
I like people watching.
Yeah, it's all of that. And the different, you know, structures and things like that. But originally, I wanted to go to school for journalism. So I kept it as a minor. But when I was in school for journalism, I realized it's not what I really wanted to do after.
That's good. Yeah.
As far as the way that they were teaching in journalism school, because I had a lot of, as far as, like, like how I'm doing now, I have my opinion about things, my interests. And you had to be really neutral in journalism, and you couldn't be biased.
It's bullshit. That's probably, we were talking about this, too. That's why I left Oh, I didn't say why I left. I just said because I was fucking fed up with school. But that's part of the reason why I left journalism straight up is there's that I guess rule is the best way to put it of you have to be neutral and unbiased and you have to present the facts. But it's hard to do that when the fucking systems that are controlling that and basically dictating that are white supremacist systems that have been corrupt for like since the beginning. So I was like, fuck this, I'm out of here.
Yeah, it was hard to really, like, I understand you have to have the facts. I like that part, getting the facts and stuff, but the part about, you know, having you, I guess there was creative journalism or you could do like feature stories and stuff like that.
Not as much as it is now, though. That's right. For sure.
Exactly. So I just felt like, and then also they were catering towards a younger, you had to have this, especially you wanted to get in TV or any kind of that type of journalism.
TV journalism.
So I was already a little bit older student. So I just felt, I didn't feel like a part of it. It just didn't connect. But I did learn a lot from learning about the whole way, how you...
The inverted pyramid, how to write, how to conduct interviews.
Yes, so that was good, and I definitely took from that.
Nice.
But actually being in the industry, no, but it's interesting how now we all could be our own journalists, so things change.
Hood journalist, like neighborhood reporter.
Exactly.
You know, democratized technology and access to information.
Exactly.
Which is also the problem with the 2016 election.
It's pros and cons, right?
Yeah. It's about balance and being critical of things and not believing everything you read on the internet, especially now. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. We'll have another discussion on that.
Yeah. So when with you, you know, learning different ways to conduct research and really kind of like getting into your own of like, oh, I really enjoy doing this. You're taking photos of places and as you're getting older too, you're appreciating things and seeing things from a different perspective. When did you like start really like feeling comfortable when you were able to like, we can walk somewhere and you can point out, oh, that's this style of architecture. Mm-hmm. That's that style of architecture. And did you know that this architecture, you know, kind of having that wealth of knowledge that you can just recall at any time?
Yeah. So I think so when I first started kind of getting more interested in the architecture of things, I wasn't posting on this public page I have right now. It was randomly on my own personal page.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I would just, you know, post this old building I would like because I like how it looked. Maybe I knew, like, the basic of maybe the style of architecture it was, but not fully. It was just a building I posted, like, and I liked it, and that's it. But I would say it got more detailed, like looking at the architecture style and learning from when I restarted this Instagram in 2019.
Nice.
Because now I was digging into the years, the type of architecture was. So doing that constantly, I got to really have an eye for what is what. And there's still a lot to learn because there's so many different details. Like, mm-hmm. For example, an Art Deco building has different like lines and, you know, the different chevrons and all kinds of little details, which I don't know fully until, I'm sure an architect is going to know those details.
Yeah.
But I'm from researching these buildings, I get to learn some of that too.
Yeah, that's dope. Because I think this will be a really big challenge, and you can probably speak to it more than I can, is you're well-versed enough to be able to like kind of distinguish different things,
yes.
Right? But the problem with buildings is that they get old and they get like torn down and damaged and they change. Mm-hmm. And is that hard sometimes? We're like, oh, this building's too damaged. I can't tell what it is or what it used to be.
Not so much. I mean, if something is too damaged, it's usually like something that probably is going to get hit up and bombed up. And it's usually probably a newer type of structure. Not newer, but just
more recent.
A Home Depot type of building.
Yeah. Prefabricated.
Yeah. And if it's something like more, and there is stuff that has that historical architecture, like Art Deco or Spanish Revival or any of that has been not taken care of over the years, but you could still kind of tell what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be destroyed probably, but you could still see the features of it that let you know, okay, this is an old Art Deco building. There's a lot of that, like, in South Central.
Yeah.
And Compton area, a lot of old buildings that don't have a lot of care to them, but you can still see what they are.
In doing research like that, with different architecture styles being more prevalent in different communities, has that kind of research led you to, like, stumble onto other things? Because as you were saying that, I kind of started putting two and two together of how, okay, for example, let's say there's a specific style of architecture that's prevalent in South Central. My immediate thinking goes to, oh, well, back in the day, white people used to live there. So that must have been why, like, they chose to have that kind of architecture. And then after they left, you know, people just kind of inherited what was there without really knowing why our houses look like this or why everybody's houses looks the same and things like that. Have you, like, come across moments like that when you're doing research and you kind of put, like, two and two together of, like, oh, well, that makes sense because, like, this area used to be this and these people used to live there?
Well, in a sense, because, like, of course, like, for example, Art Deco was, you know, late 20s, 30s, and mm-hmm. then the Spanish Revival, also the 20s, and then the Streamline came, like, 30s, which is a sister or brother of Art Deco.
Yeah.
And then
I'm just like, yeah,
like the craftsman homes were like early 1900s, even to the 20s. Yes. Yeah, so obviously early on in LA, there was not that many Latinos or Mexicans or whatever.
Not
so,
a lot of people too either.
Yeah. So of course the people that were living there were going to be the original people. We could go way back on that. But the people that probably built the house or had an architect or the architects that built the community or whatnot. But I do see, like, with, like, for example, in now more prevalent, like, Latino prevalent hoods, where it's, like, you could tell it's a Spanish Revival home. With it's covered by, you know, the gates, and, like, maybe they, you know, have a bunch of plants covering it or something. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't even know what the architecture is, you know?
That's something I've never thought about anywhere I lived.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes they, you know, the person might not renovate it in the proper type of preserve way mm-hmm. because they just don't know, and that's not something they just want to get a new door or a gate.
Yeah.
Some people don't know because they just don't know, but some people do kind of mess it up.
They just see it as a property, like, I need to fix this and get people in here to pay me rent.
Yeah, so there's that. I mean, but then again, I understand not everybody has this passion for architecture or understands it or embraces it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that's not really taught in school in any capacity unless you actively seek for it. Like, seek it out, right? So, I mean, there is a disservice that now, especially now more than ever, especially in communities like Boyle Heights and Filipino Town and South Central, that as, like, gentrification is just running wild, more of those homes, like, the way you just described it, right? That they'll either get fixed up, like, Mickey Mouse, or they'll just get completely torn down, and then completely you change the identity of the neighborhood because they just want to get a condominium in their apartments or something.
Yeah, and as far as the architecture, what I knew about it before any of this research or anything was your tío going to Home Depot and, like, making a back room, you know?
Grandma house. The grandma flat, as they call it.
Did he have an architect doing a blueprint? Probably not. I don't even know how they got the print. We should interview somebody. What do they do? I don't know.
That's just ingenuity. It's like, I got this. You know, yeah. I'll figure it out as I go along.
So I just kind of knew building like that until, you know, you started appreciating the beauty of actual architecture. Mm. But that's something I had to discover on my own and not because it was ever taught or, you know, any
of that.
And this
is on the side, too. You didn't make this your career or anything. This is just something you're passionate about.
Right. And just history of along with the architecture of whatever it was back, you know, whatever it was at the time. And I, like, really like learning about that.
Hell yeah. I share that passion of, like, wanting to learn what happened before and having more context, because that often more than not helps provide more context for what's going on right now in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So with you know, you going and taking photography classes, journalism classes, when did you decide, or, well, actually, how did you decide to start a blog?
The first one, as far as Swami Chronicles,
Well, I have it here. You were on MySpace first.
Yeah. So just like anybody else, you know, social media. And they didn't even call it social media back then.
No.
I think it was just literally it was. MySpace.
If you're in our age group.
So just open up an account like anybody else. And it was the first time you were able to kind of chat with your friends online. Everybody was on there, I guess. They're starting to get on there. And I believe, and this is something that I wish I could go back into, because I can't get into my MySpace account, and I don't even know if you could.
At one point, you could. When Justin Timberlake bought it and tried to make it into like a whole new service thing, they emailed people to like, hey, MySpace is like da 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 da. If you want your shit, get it out now. And I was able to get like some old posts from that.
Because there was a blog section on there.
Yeah.
And I had done a few blogs. Like, I can't remember what it was. But I lost that, and I lost my photo bucket.
Yeah.
Because that was part of that.
Photo bucket.
Yeah, that was before Flickr, even.
That was before a lot of things. Because in order to put pictures in MySpace in your profile and blog posts, you have to get the HTML code from Photo Bucket and drop it in.
And I lost the access to that. I don't know. So I don't even remember what I posted about, but it was a few things on the MySpace blog that they had on there.
Yeah. Like so I went back to your blog, and this is the first blog post from 2007, September 20, 2007. The title is New Person. this is what you wrote. What up, people? I decided to start my second blog I had on MySpace, but nobody really seems to pay attention to MySpace blogs unless you're a skonka with 50,000 friends, LOL.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, we'll let you see what I'm going to talk about, all kinds of random things. So I hope we'll be posting more stuff soon. Exclamation
random
point.
Hero.
That's hilarious.
That was a little shout out to you before we knew it.
But no, I was like, I felt that because I was like, yeah. We were talking about this before recording, that social media now is that's what it is. And Instagram influencers, TikTok influencers, you know, if you're not putting up numbers, nobody's really paying attention to stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So not much has changed. But so you went from MySpace, then you transitioned to Blogspot. What were you thinking?
With the Blogspot, it was a natural progression because, again, just like the MySpace, a lot of people, that was pretty much the evolution of blogs. I think they started coming out during that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think because I already kind of had an idea that I wanted to do photography or journalism, and I was reading a lot of blogs at the time, attention span was greater.
It's different, that's for sure.
Yeah. Then I think I just naturally... I can't remember, like, why I did it. Or I think it just was... I want to put, you know, my photos out there and maybe experiment with writing. And that's kind of how that started.
Nice. Yeah, basically the same as me. Like, you have a personal outlet to put up your stuff and what you see. So with you, I think that's what I really appreciated about your older posts now. And we talked about this too, that you have a lot of old photos of the neighborhood, like things that you've been to. And now I think I treasure and value that kind of stuff a lot more because so much more time has passed. Just things keep changing. And I'm like, man, like more people need to archive and document what's going on. So that way, I mean, the conversation about whether something should stay and be fixed or maintained and all that kind of stuff, that goes in a whole different direction. But at least having photos and video and something to say that used to be there and this is what it used to look like would be awesome.
Right. And even that, like the archiving, was out of reach during that time.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember saying to, you know, my friends that when I would talk about what I want to do in college or whatever, like, I want to be like an archivist, but back then it's like, what, one person does that job? You know, it wasn't something that there was job opportunities like, and you know, maybe another type of job.
No, not the way other professions are supported, and there's like networking and scholarships and things like that.
So I just felt like I could never reach that, I guess, at the time.
I feel that. I feel that. That's very, like, academic.
It is. So, or you had to be a librarian or something, mm-hmm. which at the time I didn't really know how to even go that route or nothing about it. So it was just a thought, but it, but now it's interesting because it came full circle and you could be your own archivist. Yeah. And we have been archiving for years.
Yeah.
Maybe not for an institution or any other, you know, big newspaper or anything, but it's on our own realm, which matters too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing I've definitely put into practice over the years is being a lot more intentional with, like, the photos, especially for my cell phone, and backing them up. And at this point, I'm like, oh, I still have stuff from, like, 2007. Should I delete them? It's like, no, just keep those photos, and maybe one day I'll need them or something.
Yeah.
As random as they are.
Yeah, I recently had to buy an external hard drive because I had this old desktop that had my first photos when you were able to became digital, you know. Mm. So I you know, luckily the desktop still turns on because I could have lost that, you know,
if
data.
If the computer goes, it goes.
Yeah. And I wanted to put it away because it's just taking space and it's been dusty for years. And I was like, I need to get an external hard drive, put all those files there. Now it's in a little thin hard drive and they're safe.
Safe.
And, you know, doing that is kind of part of the archive process.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you got to put your systems in place, back up your computer regularly, all that kind of stuff. The same with your phone. Empty out all the photos, put them in a hard drive, and now you have a fresh, empty phone for new photos.
Yes. I got to do that next.
It's a pain in the butt, but as soon as you develop your own step-by-step process and regular intervals of doing that kind of stuff, it just becomes something you do. Like, you know, cleaning your house on Sunday or, like, cooking dinner and things like that.
That's very true.
So, practice makes perfect. With the blog, why did you name it Swamp Meat Chronicles?
You want to get deep, huh? Well, so right here, there's a swamp meet called Harbor College, which is part of the community college.
The community colleges, all nine of them had some of the best swamp meets, I remember.
So, and I have, people have asked me, like, why that? But it's an interesting story. Like, in high school, we used to clown about the things that we did on a normal basis, like what we see now with Fools Gone Wild. Right?
Yeah,
it's all in good humor, but it's like we could kind of clown on our own selves in a way, in a funny way, right?
Yeah.
So we used to clown within ourselves about, you know, we started a thing called Swami Klika. It was just a fake Glica, and we all had dumb names, just like you see now. I think La Chona, Jeronimo, Pancho. We were all people, but we were just a clown. And mine was Doña Junta. You know, we were, I don't know how you would say that. We were clowny, but also embracing our own culture.
You make fun of yourselves. You don't take yourself too seriously, and you see the humor in what y'all live. So to me, that's like, yeah, we appreciate this because we're able to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah. So, you know, back then, I feel like swap meets were more popular back then.
Oh,
maybe they're
coming
back now.
For a lot of different reasons, because I think back then, the biggest thing about them was like that's the community hub for not only getting cheap things that you could only get there. Like for me, I still make regular visits to the swap meet to get huaraches. Because I know I'll get a good deal, right?
Yeah.
Or I can talk to whoever's selling them to me to, like, knock off a buck or two or whatever. So, specific things like that. But especially now that I'm getting older and I see more and more swap meets closing down, it's like, damn, this is not just a place to come and shop. It's a place where, like, the community got together. And you spend a Sunday there, you go eat, you bring the family. You of course, you do some shopping, but most swap meets, like, they will put on a show Saturday or Sunday, bring on live music. Mm-hmm. Like, the Alameda swap meet before the pandemic had fucking mini horses for the kids to ride.
Oh, wow.
It smelled like fucking... It smells so bad.
Crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, there's a horse. And then I was like, and then I would get really sad because I was like, shit, there's a llama, too. And I was like, ah, oh, these poor animals.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, and a part of it was growing up, your parents didn't go to the mall. They would take you on Sunday to the swap meet.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the culture. And then, so, we would clown around like that. We worked at the swap meet. It was, I don't know, we were like, had a good imagination. We would just Shoot the shit, talk crap about, you know, you saw colchones and almohadas.
Just because that's what people sold at the swap meet.
Yeah, and we had this whole little identity of who we were at the swap meet. So that the swap meet part started there. And then because I wanted to make it like a photography, like writing the chronicles, like, okay, I'm going to make it Swap Meet Chronicles to make it like a sort of a newspaper type of thing,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
So, but it started from high school and kind of just embracing, like you said, making fun of our own identities in a sense. And it was just so funny. And you see that now with these comedians and doing skits online. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're like talking about señoras and about cheesemen, about things that it's so out there, but it's so funny. And like you could laugh at it. And that's kind of how we were doing it, but in real life. And
yeah,
it wasn't recorded.
It was genuine. Yeah. You weren't out here trying to be on TikTok.
No. So yeah, that's kind of how that evolved.
So when with the blog and then you became part of LA East Side, you were pretty active for like a good while, right?
Yeah, I believe I want to say 2007 was when I first opened up the Blogspot.
Yeah, Swami yeah, Chronicle. I just read the date.
Yeah, 2007, and then those I want to say those like 4 years, and then I think LA East Side came shortly after. I don't know if mm-hmm. you look back at when it first opened.
But it's around that ballpark. Don't have an exact date right now.
So I think it was pretty a hot thing for like, I want to say 4 years, five maybe.
This is a good chunk of time.
Yeah, it was. And then I don't know what started happening. Well, I know what happened. Like the other social media started opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And people were less interested in reading blogs. And I think Twitter was starting to come out. We were all up on Twitter.
Yeah.
Before now, like I don't really know the Twitter now, but when Twitter first came out, you were on there too, with Gallo and all them.
I mean, at this point, whenever anything new comes out, any new social media platform comes out, I just go on there to save my name. Like,
I don't know
if I'll use it or have a use for it at one point, but I'll just set up an account and hold my name in place in case I ever do need to use it.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just started kind of declining, and you know yourself that it just started declining. And even, like, I guess, not that I lost interest, but I wasn't putting in the effort, maybe because there wasn't the audience anymore, or no. Our friends started kind of also not being communicating as much. Because if you remember from LA East Side, we would meet, we would have meetings,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We had like dinners and stuff like
barbecues.
That. Yeah. So it felt like really community, like we would do things together and we were all into the same things. But then little by little, you know, people move on and, you know, like we lose contact, and
yeah.
It was part of that. And then the social media, the Twitters came out.
Yeah, the landscape changed again.
Facebook, mostly Facebook for many years, and then the Instagram, and, you know, now YouTube and
TikTok and Snapchat.
Your
fucking attention is divided in like 10 different places and shit instead of one now.
Right, and then the, like I was saying, the micro blogging.
That's essentially what it all is.
Yes.
It's micro blogging.
Very short, get to the point.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were blogging on Blogspot, were we that short?
No.
No.
That's probably because we didn't know better.
but even now on Instagram, I have long captions, but, you know, I don't care. I want to be able to put what I want to put on there. If you read the caption, great. If you don't, at least look at the picture.
If you read it, you get the full context of what you're posting, because you post multiple pictures, yeah.
Right. So, and then there is people that, you know, are more into it, and some people that, again, the attention span could be very hard for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Even for myself in certain things. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you were we're fairly active for a while, and then the way I have it is around 2012-2013 you took a break. Like you weren't as active as you previously were, and we don't have to get into it because I know life happens, and you know, like you're saying, people transition and mm-hmm. other priorities come around. But you started picking it up again in 2019. What was that?
What happened, huh?
Well, not what happened, but like to talk about it the last couple of years. In 2019, what was it for you that's like, huh, I want to get back into this?
So, Yeah, so I got lost in the sauce as far as, okay, I stopped blogging. We all did. I don't know if you did. You had a website, I think, right?
No, well, mine was therapy, so I needed that.
You were a little bit more advanced. You had
I mean, that's what I went to school for.
You had
.com. Yeah. I didn't get that until, like, recently, honestly.
So I let go of the blog. Not let it go, but it just stayed stagnant. And not just me, everybody else that was we were following. Because I guess you could follow people on there, too, in a weird, different way. So it wasn't just me. It happened across the board. And I did have an Instagram. So it was a private Instagram. Just my personal Instagram with friends and family. And let's just say you run into somebody at a show, I'll add you. But it wasn't, like, public at all. Because most of it wasn't about being public when you first started. It was just still your private, family photos.
Look at what we're doing. Look at what I'm eating. Yeah.
Eating, the food thing came. So I did start two blogs kind of after I finally finished everything. The Donut Shop blog is called Donut Shop Conspiracy. And that came way after with one of my friends, Tony, because we would always, when we were painting, we would stop at Donut Shops late night.
I was a fan of that. I love donuts.
Yeah. So that was like a little niche blog that we made, like Donut Shop Conspiracy.
Imagine if you made a Donut Conspiracy account for Instagram.
I didn't do Instagram. I did a Twitter one.
Okay.
Because that's when Twitter first started, and I was promoting it on Twitter, and then so I did start the donut shop. It was very niche, and it was in more of a review, like where you review a place, like review a restaurant or.
It's a food influencer.
Yeah, it did start a lot of that because as you know, Gallo, if you know him.
I was just eating barbecue with him.
There you go. He's still eating. We're all eating, but he's still like very good about. He's a foodie.
Yeah, he put me onto a really dope pupusa spot.
Nice.
Yeah.
So he started a blog too, and we would review different things, and then the donut shop thing with my friend Tony. So I did start those because food, taking pictures of food was like a thing for a little bit.
Yeah, still is. People make a job out of it.
It's kind of boring now. Like I hardly take pictures of my food, but back then it was like so exciting. I don't know why.
Because it was new. It was different. Nobody was really doing that.
So I just started my, you know, that kind of faded out. And then I started my personal Instagram. And then I would take pictures of, you know, some of these places, architecture, you know, just what I liked. But most of the time, you're not going to get people interested that, you know, as much as a niche audience, like right now that it's a public page.
Yeah.
It's just not the same. Because I have done a lot of reposts of some of the old buildings from my personal one, and it's been a whole different
you can see the reaction. Difference. Yeah. You get a lot of quality comments of people like genuinely like, oh wow, I didn't know that, or people who had some interaction with the space at some point or another, or just folks like genuinely curious. It's like, oh, I learned something new today.
Right. So the Instagram, the personal one, stayed like that, like just my own thing, I guess, up until 2019. And I wasn't really focusing on it just because there wasn't an audience for it, and I would just post randomly, but it started to get boring, to be honest.
Yeah.
Until 2019, and what happened was that my niece, she's a, you know, a teenager. Well, she's 19 now.
Oh, wait. It's a bee. Hold on, it's sucking your hair. Bee paws. Hold on, no. Hold on, let me get it. At first, it was like a little gnat. Got it. Here. Got it. See, you want to see it?
No.
There you go, B.
We are at a park, so I can't get too mad.
What? I've had like kids just run behind us at some point. A different park.
So she started reading my Swami Chronicles because I did used to write history of growing up in San Pedro in my area during the 80s and 90s. So she was learning from our family history.
How did she learn about it?
How did she what?
Learn about it. Did you tell her?
Yeah, I told her. I used to like blog. Because there was a time when she was in high school that she worked for the yearbook. Oh. And she wanted to get into possibly journalism.
That's a good start, yeah.
Yeah, at the time. Now she switched it. But at the time, she was interested in it. So I had told her that that was something I wanted to do. And I showed her. And then she kind of explored the blog on her own and nice. Learned a lot from that. And she would always ask me, why don't you blog anymore and things like that. And she was like, you should put it on Instagram. So at first I was like, I don't know. Having a public page is very different than your own personal mm-hmm. lockdown page. Mm-hmm. But this is already an era where everything's public. You know, a lot of, you know, Instagram completely is different now than when it first started.
Yep.
So I just was like, you know something? I'm just going to try it out. And if I only have my friends and the ones that care about the content following, that's fine. And it'll be public. I just didn't really know I didn't know what to expect of it.
But you're just out there like, all right, let me try to put it out there. Just
right.
Supportive.
Just throwing it out there without knowing any, like, that there was any kind of history of people interested in history or architecture or any of that.
Did, before doing that, have you come across any other, like, niche accounts like that? Because of what you're doing and how you're doing, the first one I comes to mind, because they also have, like, similar intentions, is the... Damn it, I'm brain farting. the party scene account.
Oh, yeah.
Rolas? No. Damn, it's on the tip of my tongue.
There's like a 90s or... I remember with the pictures of like...
One of them is Map Points.
I seen that,
like the Instagram Map Points. But basically, you know, archiving different scenes. And that's kind of what you're doing now, too, with like old photos and specifically architecture. Mm-hmm. So did you ever come across like accounts like that before?
Yeah, when I had the personal page, I did see some of those, like, with pictures of the 90s. I think it was the 90s. The
parties and
rebels
things like
and
that.
Parties.
And
yeah. And then when I created mine, then I started kind of seeing, you know, the other people doing similar things. Especially when you start posting and hashtagging and people start finding your stuff.
Yeah, I'm bad at hashtagging. I think they're annoying.
But it's really, really a helpful way, because now you can follow hashtags and that's where they end up. So that's been able to, for me to discover audiences that are into this, not just audiences, but other people into the same type of things and doing similar things in their own way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about before how CVS goes into places and like just opens up in historic landmark buildings. What this is something I just wanted to get your like feelings and opinions about in terms of where the conversation goes from like archiving to preservation. Because I know there's organizations, there's nonprofits, there's people, there's even community groups that, you know, they go above and beyond of like, no, don't tear down this building. You know, we need to preserve it because, you know, Hitler had a baby here or like some random historical fact. That merits that preservation. But how do you feel about like, because you've come across so many different spaces and you've seen them in different times of their life, from being completely dilapidated to, you know, being restored. Mm-hmm. You know, where is that line of like, let's just tear this down and take photos, or let's preserve this for future generations?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people that are very involved in preservation, and I see a lot of those people that online as well have their own passion with preservation. Mm-hmm. And people that are going to even like city council meetings and try to get landmarks and historical buildings registered and all that.
Doing the work.
Like that's like definitely a whole nother level that of work that, you know, is very important. I haven't got to that point where I'm advocating for that, and I definitely want, you know, hopefully in the future be more involved in helping in that way as well, like preserving some of these places.
Yeah.
So that's definitely something that I want to learn more about and be part of. I guess those people are putting in that work so it could be a saved or restored or preserved mm-hmm. in a way that it's not going to be like the building I posted, the last one.
It just gets painted over,
Yeah. And it just... lost a lot of the aesthetic charm that it had.
So
that's something I definitely I'm hoping to, you know, dive more into as I'm learning more and more.
Well, like, because some of the places that come to mind are the Sears building. You were just there not too long ago, too.
Yes.
And it's in the news as of late, as of recording this episode, with that this month in April, that the store is finally going to shut down, and that's it. That's all the store wrote. And if you're familiar with that situation, the plans, as I understand it, is that the new owner of the building is trying to do housing, but not, you know, affordable housing or anything. It's just condos and lofts and things like that at market rate.
Yes.
So, I mean, the Sears building becomes one of those, to me, one of those places of contention of, for me personally, I'm like, fuck Sears. This is a fucking store. I understand that people grew up with it and they have memories of it, but I'm like, that's fucking capitalism. We shouldn't get attached to fucking commercialism like that.
Yeah.
That's how we ended up with the fucking Nike store in Whittier Boulevard that Cholos were fucking protecting during like the 2020, you know, uprisings and all the gatherings that were happening. So
I heard about that.
Yeah. So for me, I'm like, I understand it. My parents, you know, also benefited from like a store like that giving them credit cards and being able to afford, you know, washing machines and TVs and shit like that. But I'm not attached to a company. Like, fuck Sears. Like, I my understanding of the history of that store and the company in general is very racist. You know, it's very problematic. And it's not like they were doing us a favor by opening up in the hood. They just know, like any other business, that if you open up in certain places, you'll make money. So for me, I mean, I'm with like a lot of folks with it should have affordable housing and be something that complements the neighborhood. But the dude straight up bought it and owns it. And this is America. He can do whatever the fuck he wants with it. So it's hard.
And it's been going like that for many years, that they're going to do something with it. Didn't Oscar De La Hoya want to buy it or something like that?
A lot of people did. It's a gigantic space.
Yeah. And I think for me, it wasn't really the Sears memory of Sears. It was more the architecture of the space, Art Deco.
Art Deco, right?
And it's just massive.
It is.
Massive. So it has a big presence. So
I wouldn't want to go inside, fuck.
Yeah. So that's kind of the part that attracted me more, rather than, you know, the actual store Sears. But I guess the idea of Sears is very historical for like the parents and growing up going to the county candy counter that they say they had. I never been in that growing up, but I went to the Sears over here.
I'm like, I remember doing the same thing when, if you remember this, for some of y'all that are older and Latino, the Dierdens.
Yeah. Yeah.
The last one that closed was in downtown.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember going, I was like, I told Marisol, I was like, hey, let's go to the Dierdens. Because it's closing down. I'm just a fucking vulture. I'm just trying to get a deal. I went to the closing on the last day, and I ended up leaving with, like, a super cheap computer monitor.
Oh. Which is sitting in the dust now?
Nah, that's what I use for work.
Oh. Wow. Still hanging in there.
Since day one, I've been using the cheap-ass monitor that cost me $50. Shit.
Nice.
Ruining my eyesight every day.
Huh.
But, yeah, I'm not attached to places like that. But then, like I said, like the CVS thing is like a very specific situation, because they did it once. It's like, all right, I guess that was that one thing, like that was gonna happen. But they've been consistent about doing that in so many different stores, and not just in LA, but in other cities, like up in the Bay. So I'm like, what the hell is wrong with CVS? And like always trying to, you know, move into these like historic buildings and be like, yeah, we're gonna be here. And then it's like a weird mix of CVS and whatever was there.
I remember there was a fight, I think, for the theater.
Mm-hmm.
They were either going to tear it down or try to, or they didn't want CVS to come into it. Something
Nobody
like that.
Nobody wants CVS.
Yeah, but I believe, I'm sure, because CVS had the money.
Oh, yeah, they have the resources.
Yeah, but if you ever get a chance to look at the store, it's super awkward. It feels awkward, looking at it, because it just doesn't go with what it was.
This is the one, it used to be a movie theater on Atlantic and Whittier in East LA.
Yes, yeah. And it's a CVS. And I know they fought to keep the details of it. And if you go inside, you still see like the facade.
They dropped down the ceilings and they just kind of built around it.
But I don't know, it just seems awkward to me. And there's some swap meets like that in MacArthur Park too that are swap meets, which, God, I love the swap meet.
Well, they used to be movie theaters before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, And they probably will never be movie theaters again. I don't know, maybe, but it just looks weird, I guess. But then again, I always kind of, the churches and the theaters are not my thing. the church part, but then I had to really think, okay, I'm just glad they're saving it, I guess, or paying rent. I don't know.
There's one specific building like that in Bull Heights, specifically like a couple of blocks where I live, the Victory Outreach building on First Street and St. Louis, which is like, the police station is right here, and then the building's right here. So they're in a 100-plus-year-old building that used to be a movie theater, and they took over like in the late 80s and 90s, and it's been a church ever since.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I was like, man, kick that church out. Build a movie theater.
Yeah, most of the movie theater has been taken over by churches.
Yeah. I made that joke on Twitter, and it didn't go anywhere. About like how in the pandemic, all these movie theaters are going to close. Is Victory Outreach going to take them over?
Yeah.
But all right, so now we can talk about where you are at right now in terms of this journey of being a street archivist and documentation, and really progressing, you know, in terms of how you present this information now, from something that you were curious about and passionate about, so now being more formal about it and still carrying that passion. So tell folks about your new podcast.
Yes, so we started a podcast late last year, and I had the idea like in the back of my head for a long time, but you know, just having to execute it. But it's called Beyond the Facade, and the idea comes from being able to have conversations or discussions about some of the places that, you know, we're exploring and documenting on my page and my friend's page too, you know. But it's also, we wanted to do a combination between the stuff that I do with the research and exploring these buildings. And then she could add her paranormal experiences with some of these places as well.
This is your co-host, Sabrina.
Yes. So she also enjoys the historical part, of course, but she could also add her niche, which is the paranormal investigation, because she's been into a lot of the buildings to investigate.
Yeah, that's always fun to like hear their like take on it. And be like, I was in here with the Geiger meter.
So we just kind of combine our interests to talk about some of these places that we've gone to in the way that we experience it, or share some of the history of kind of like I'm doing on the Instagram, but in more detail, and just conversate about what it is, or whatever our experience was there, if we're connected to it. Sometimes we're connected to it, sometimes we might not, but we still wanted to, you know, have a discussion. And now we want to be able to also interview people that are connected to the type of things that we're interested in, like history, architecture, and hear their stories of, you know, why, you know, they're interested in this or whatever they're doing with their work, either online or in real life. There's some people that actually are preservationists or architects or explorers or whatever it is. So hearing their story, too, is another part that we want to start doing.
Hell yeah. Yeah, the episode y'all did on the Biltmore Hotel was really cool.
The Cecil?
I mean, why did I say the Biltmore? Fuck yeah.
We are going to do the Biltmore, though.
But no, the Cecil.
Foreseeing the future.
Yeah. No, because it ties into like the Netflix documentary come out. Mm-hmm. And both of y'all having personal experiences with being there at different times before and after what happened. And yeah, that place is straight up haunted. Even before that, it's just straight up haunted.
Right. So, yeah, that was fun, being able to, like, in that case, we did tie it in with the documentary. But we had a lot of history of, she had her paranormal experience, or paranormal. And then I had being able to go to Al Guerrero's tour that he had there and learning about it. So that was interesting. Definitely a good place. Well, you can't go there right now, but
no, it's closed. I passed by it the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with the podcast, was it intimidating for both of y'all to get into this? Because this is something new. I mean, essentially, you're continuing what you've always been doing, and you've been really good about adapting and, you know, staying up to date with different formats, from like MySpace to blogging to, you know, social media. And now with audio, it is a little bit more formal because it's completely different. You're no longer writing.
Yeah, so that is a definitely new transition with audio, and you know, also video, in a sense that could be connected to it too. But mm-hmm. we're trying to take it one step at a time. You know, learn the audio and how to do that. And luckily, now it is more accessible for people.
Yeah.
I know podcast has been around for a long time, and I know you had yours for a long time, and people have connections to studios and stuff like that. It just seemed impossible to me at one point. Like, how do they do it? But now there is more resources to be able to do your own thing.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of that, of how things are now with technology. Like, anybody could do it. It's not so restricted anymore.
No. But accessible. It's definitely a little bit more affordable on the tech side, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And but it's just about taking that step to just try it out, even if maybe you don't know anything about it, but just taking that risk and, you know, learning as you go.
Yeah, that's honestly some of the best advice you can give anybody who's curious about starting something. It was just go out there and do it. You know, you can learn. I've learned a lot of things as I went along, as y'all have heard, mm-hmm. specifically on this podcast. If you've been listening from day one, I've definitely improved in terms of quality of sound and the way I interview folks. At one point I was interviewing somebody and the mic was on a stand and it just completely fell.
Oh no.
It just made a bunch of noise and I left it in there. Like, I left that audio noise in there.
Oh no. So yeah, the technology part, it could be a little confusing, but I think with practice, you know,
yeah.
it'll get better. And same thing with YouTube. Like, it seems kind of easy, but it's kind of hard. So that's another challenge. But nowadays, again, you could learn everything on YouTube, how to do things.
Yeah.
So that's the nice thing about that. Just, and then with, like anybody else, it takes practice and they're not gonna come off so professional right away.
No, for sure. But y'all are off to a good start. Where do y'all see the podcast going in the future?
I think a lot of we do eventually want to maybe travel to locations, or if we're not doing the podcast at a location, but travel and then come back and talk. So travel more to be able to talk about different places across the country, not just LA.
Yeah.
And then what I really want to do is talk to these people and interview these people that on, you know, in the Instagram world, or I don't know what you want to call it, that also have these accounts that are, that they're passionate with architecture, they're passionate with history, and or even whether it's LA or anything else.
Yeah,
like, man, getting to know their story, just like, you know, we're talking right now.
Exactly.
Because, you know, I think it's interesting. I want to get to know more what they have to say.
Yeah. The one thing I kind of assume, but I mean I don't want to assume either, is that eventually somewhere down of the pandemic, that y'all could do live tours of places.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And now, I mean, getting to know the different equipment and stuff. So, you know, thank you for veteran podcasters.
Yeah, I'm happy to share and support anybody starting their journey and offering, you know, the mistakes I've have made mm-hmm. and learned from, which there are many. But yeah, where can folks listen to the show? Where can they find you?
So my personal Instagram is SwapMeet_chronicles, and that's the Instagram. And my friend Sabrina is Observing Spooks and Other Vices. So she's on there as well, and then we have links to the podcast. And you can find it on Spotify, you know, Anchor, the Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, most major podcast platforms, yeah.
Yeah, the link is in my bio. Link in my bio.
It is. So yeah, for sure I will link your Instagram account mm-hmm. in the episode description. Of course I'll tag you when I have this up on my own Instagram to promote the show, and of course I'll share a link to the podcast. But you can also just find it by searching for the name of the show on wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, Beyond the Facade. And again, we also want to hopefully put the interviews or our discussions on YouTube.
I just saw you put one up right now. Yeah,
so we're still experimenting with that, just like the audio, but
keep at it. Yeah.
So some people are more visual. I know I like to listen to a lot of podcasts on YouTube. I know people don't consider YouTube a podcast, but it's changing, and So if you like to hear it on YouTube, we're trying to get more on there. And so
y'all are just making it more accessible so people can just vibe with it at their own convenience and not be like stuck to like, I can only listen to it here or there or whatever.
Right. And you just, again, the beauty of being able to have more access to do a podcast, I would never have thought until I tried it.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad y'all did. And you're like starting out this journey. You know, like I said, I'm happy to support any way I can, offer any kind of advice. You know, if it gets to the point where y'all are doing something like a fundraiser or something to get equipment, mm-hmm. you know, count me in to help and support. So
awesome.
Anything I can do, I'm here. And yeah, I'll have all the description for the show and Instagram tags in the episode description. And I think we're done because all these bugs are starting to come around. Well, yeah, that's been Orale Bolhaita. Thanks, y'all, for listening. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you.